Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and best-selling author Ron Suskind is here to discuss his brand new book, already making news, called Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. The LA Times today says no book about President Obama seems to have unnerved the White House as much as this one. Previously, Suskind was unnerving the Bush administration with books like The Price of Loyalty, which documented how they started planning a war in Iraq 8 months before 9/11. Suskind also spent 7 years as the Wall Street Journal's chief national affairs correspondent. Hi, Ron. Welcome back to WNYC.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Brian.
You have 500 pages here. I think the headline is Progressive Obama Misplaces His Faith in Relatively Conservative Economic Advisors Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, allowing the banks to roll the country after the financial crisis. Am I on the right track?
You're damn close, Brian. That seems to be certainly one of the headlines. That may be right near the top. He got rolled. He missed his moment. I think everybody agrees on that. And it's a little hard to read that part. I mean, the damn thing is like an adventure story. It's got ups and downs. You know, the bullets fly, the boulders roll. But Obama had clearly a crossroads opportunity, a real moment in that early part of the administration. They've sloughed this off. But when you read it, you're like, geez, what was he thinking? You know, the bankers themselves were saying, just do it to us. You know, shove the spear in our chest. You know, we're not good for America.
They were? I thought they were saying, bail me out with the TARP program.
Well, this is what they were saying to their wives, Brian. You know, one of them said, you know, I'm an American too, you know. I'm not just a CEO of a financial institution. He had
Well,
his
what
chance.
Did they want? Did they want Obama to nationalize the banks or something?
Well, you know, some of them, you know, I think felt that really Wall Street needed to be regulated and maybe even broken up. You know, I think, you know, not that they'd ever say that publicly. Yeah. You know, that's the big part of this book. You know, a lot of the public message-driven rhetoric is just kind of fluff. It doesn't make much sense as a bunker-to-bunker conversation. What you're going to get here is what the characters in both New York and Washington really think and what really drives them in terms of intent and action, and maybe even moments where they say, you know, I should be better than this, and maybe I can get a chance to be better. You know, there's scenes in the book, because it's, you know, I'm an investigative reporter, but, you know, I guess, you know, my Pulitzer Prize is in feature writing. So my whole goal is to dig up the investigative stuff and then present it in a way that even the layman reader, as well as the expert, can say, boy, this is kind of a novel of the American experiment.
Right. And this is a Bob Woodward style book, some people might call it.
Yeah.
You know, Frank Rich, I think it was on the New York Magazine website, called it like a Halberstam Best and the Brightest,
yeah.
Only instead of, you know, Bundy and McNamara, it's Tim Geithner and Larry Summers.
I thought that was pretty damn incisive of Frank, I have to say. That was early. That came out, I guess, almost a week ago, last Saturday. They got an advanced copy. And, yeah, I think that's a fair statement. You know, who did he choose and what did that mean? It ended up being fate for Obama. You know, and early on, what's so fascinating about it is what brings him to the party is exactly the opposite. It's not guys like that. You know, the team that gathers around him during the heroic rise to the presidency, the extraordinary Barack Obama run for glory, or, you know, Paul Volcker, Bill Donaldson, who was the SEC guy under Bush who kind of got religion about regulation. You know, Bob Reich, there's a guy named Robert Wolf, who's this sort of dynamic head of UBS in America. It was a real ecumenical bipartisan group who felt the crisis coming, saw it often early, as did Obama, and said, look, this is the one chance in a generation to change the architecture of the country, the pump house that drives not just the economy, but much of American life and American culture. And, you know, Obama then, of course, rises with this crowd, you know.
And the grassroots surge for hope and change,
yeah.
Hope and change. And so Geithner and Summers represent what?
Well, Geithner and Summers mostly represent caution. You know, lots of talk, not much action in Larry's part. You know, there's a line that both of them use a lot that Obama then adopted, both Larry and Tim, called Hippocratic risk. first do no harm. And Obama says that a lot. You know, when he's really trying to rise in the early part of his administration, he's got a 70% approval rating. 2 million people were just weeping on the mall in the inauguration. You can feel him in the first month or two, like, hey, I can do this. You know, I can do this job. I don't have a lot of experience. I haven't been on the national stage that long, but hey, I get it. And he's trying to kind of ramp up on economic theory, on the way the financial markets work. And he wants to kind of do Roosevelt in March. He's really, really pressing to get some sense of how to take down the big banks. You know, not just one bank, but many banks. He says the financial system in America is busted, and that means all sorts of things go haywire. Risk is mispriced, debt essentially sold without real accountability. The country is just awash in the pressures of debt. And he in a big meeting says, "Look, I want to act. This is about accountability. This is about people being responsible for their actions." And frankly, both Democrats and Republicans are saying, "Yeah, you know, if he had done that, he would have gotten a great populist and political surge from both left and right." Standing in the way of that is Tim Geithner, who, of course, is very close to Wall Street. That is shown clearly, letter and verse, through this book. And Geithner, he believes in his stress test. Obama's not that excited about the stress test. That's the one, remember, where the government would rate the banks, kind of giving them a stamp like Moody's would. And whatever the stamp the government gives them, however you invest, for better or for worse, your investment's basically guaranteed. That's kind of the sell. You know, and that's just a way to basically have government support the banks even more than through direct federal bailout funds. And Obama's not excited about this. And at the end of a big meeting, he says, "Look, I really want a plan for how to take down Citibank. We have to do it at least for one bank. And if we do that right, we'll get money to do other banks. And more importantly, we'll show government can do this right, and it's not another Lehman out-of-control disaster. That'll kill off a lot of fear, which is a big part of what the problem is in the economy."
Is that the proposal that Geithner, as you put it, slow walks and kind of bottles it up to bury it?
That's the one. That's the one that the president orders. Pull that together, get a plan for that as quickly as possible. Geithner doesn't like this. He doesn't think the president basically knows what he's talking about, even though it's a presidential decision. 3-4 weeks later, the president's in the Oval Office. Now, 3 or 4 weeks during one of the most important crisis periods in U.S. history on this matter of a collapsed financial system, and he's talking, when Christy Romer's there, Larry Summers, Rahm Emanuel, he's talking about this Citibank plan. We're really good on this. It's going to be important. And Romer looks at Summers kind of with concern because they know Treasury's done nothing on it. And she says, "Mr. President, I don't know how to tell you this, but there is no Citibank plan." And Obama gets outraged. He says, "Well, there better be." And after the meeting, Rahm Emanuel huddles with Summers and says, "I can't believe Christie said that to him in the meeting, you know, without Tim here to defend himself." And Larry's like, "Well, Rahm, she's right."
Why did the president let him get away with it if he wanted to take down Citibank?
You know, after that, I talked to the president about it. I talked to Tim about it. Geithner, essentially, if you read the 2 pages of long quotes where we go step by step through that, you'll see that Geithner, in his own backhanded way, affirms this story and affirms the fact that he held all the cards, he, Geithner, and he played them as he saw fit. When I asked the president about it, you know, it was a moment where he was uncomfortable. No one, as president, would like to show that they've been ignored, that their will has been essentially thwarted, or that an advisor basically said, "I know more than the president, and I'm not going to do what he wants." The president said, "Look, I don't know if agitated is the right word, but you know, it was not easy, and the bureaucracy was slow, and the problems were hard." This goes to the core of some of the real issues of Obama's character and personal architecture that you feel unfolding throughout the narrative. You know, he is brilliant. There's no doubt about that. But is he brilliant in a way that makes for great presidents? That's something the reader needs to decide.
Ron Suskind, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. Questions for Ron Suskind? We'll open the phones, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post them to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. If Summers, Geithner, and Rahm Emanuel, to some degree, are the forces of darkness in this story who protect the banking industry too much, people like Elizabeth Warren, appointed to create the Consumer Credit Protection Agency, plus FDIC Chair Sheila Bair, and the elderly former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker are the forces of light. Here are contrasting clips of Geithner announcing the TARP program in 2009, the bailout of the banks, Obama edition, followed by Elizabeth Warren on this program last year saying why she thinks it was done wrong.
Those institutions that need additional capital will be able to access a new funding mechanism that uses capital from the Treasury as a bridge to private capital. The capital will come with conditions to help ensure that every dollar of taxpayer assistance is being used to generate a level of lending greater than what would have been possible in the absence of government support.
The problem is how we designed TARP from the very beginning. We sort of presumed a certain kind of problem, it's only liquidity, and we presumed a certain kind of solution, give them the money, no strings attached, and all the good things will happen. And it appears that both of those presumptions were not very well founded, and frankly, it appears that then Secretary Paulson may have known that at the time.
Bush's Treasury Secretary Paulson, who designed the TARP program with Tim Geithner at the table, Elizabeth Warren on this program this year, Treasury Secretary Geithner before that announcing the TARP program, the Obama version in 2009. Were they in some kind of opposing camp?
No doubt. And Elizabeth, I guess, is I'm not much on heroes and villains, but she is something of a hero in the book. Her journey is marked, like all the characters, all the main ones, including Obama, of course, all the way back from the summer of 2007 in Obama's case and others as well. You see their growth. You see how they got there. You see what they learned along the way and what they tried to do or not. And Elizabeth, you know, it's interesting. I think Elizabeth is right. I don't think that issue that she's talking about there was ever really confronted head on in the analysis. You know, they kept throwing money to the banks saying eventually they'll lend. The banks said we're not lending unless aggregate demand goes up in the economy. Thank you for the money, though. We can make money doing this. Of course, they could, you know, getting free money, a trained chimp could make money off of that, lending it back to the government at 3%, which is essentially a giveaway to the government of hundreds of billions of dollars to the banks. And it's interesting, you know, the kind of, you know, tough love that Elizabeth is an avatar of, just like Paul Volcker and others. You know, Obama heard that stuff, but he couldn't manage the gumption to get past first do no harm. You know, Volcker speaks, I think, passionately about this in the book. He's got lots of long sit-downs and quotes and insights. You know, Volcker is a tough cookie. He's free to say whatever the hell he pleases at this point. He's like, first do no harm. What are you kidding? Any major government action that's really going to change things, change the landscape, is going to do harm to some people, some interests that have allied or laid themselves down based on what is. You're trying to change it to what should be. Now, government might be there to cushion the blow for those interests, those powers, but, you know, it doesn't mean you shouldn't think about how you need to move forward, and some people are going to get bruised. Obama just constantly had trouble with that, and Summers was no help at all, and Geithner wasn't either. And that, I think the president takes fault for that in the final interview in the book. I mean, it's a very hard interview, I'll tell you. We sit for 50 minutes in the Oval Office. I lay down pretty much all the findings I have from 2 years of reporting in both New York and Washington, and Obama's a little bit, you know, taken aback. You know, the wind's knocked out of him a little. It's all now clear, and he knows it'll be clear in the reporting. And he says, look, this was a very difficult time, and I learned very hard lessons, some against my will. You know, I'm trying to evolve. This is about my evolution, your book, and here's how I've evolved. And he talks about, you know, being trapped in this relitigation roulette, as they call it. And Obama, he says, that's my fault, essentially. You know, I didn't break free of it. I suffer, he said, from the policy wonks disease a kind of technocratic affection, a belief that there's a solution, a perfect technical solution to things if you get enough smart people with high IQs in the room and close the door. And clearly, in a very difficult 2 years, he learned that wasn't the case. That's why I think like Frank Rich mentions the best and the brightest. That, of course, is something Kennedy ostensibly learns in that book,
sure.
too.
That's right. How did Obama put it to you? But like policy wonks disease?
Policy wonks disease. Carter Clinton and I have that, he says in the book, which, of course, caused a little panic from the White House message department, those comparisons. But at the end, we mentioned in this discussion Ronald Reagan. And you can see him kind of looking over at Reagan's kind of visage in the Oval Office as we're sitting there. Reagan has a bit of a come hither he's offering Obama. You know, Obama's like, gosh, you know, Reagan could exude confidence just like by flipping a switch. It was that actor's training. And Obama says that with some envy.
And so could Clinton. Does Obama envy Clinton's personal charm?
Well, you know, I think Obama thinks he's pretty charming, but on the other hand, I think there's times when he probably envied Clinton's fast-fire mastery of these national debates. Clinton had more experience with them than Obama did by the time they arrived at the presidency.
Ron Susskind, author of Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President, and Fred in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, thanks a lot. Mr. Susskind, I enjoyed your previous books. Looking forward to reading this one.
Great, Fred.
Okay. My wife and I were early Obama supporters, even before he was running for president.
Yeah.
And we supported him in the campaign and in the election. And even before he was inaugurated, I said to my wife, we're going to be very disappointed in him. The people you mentioned, Summers and Geithner, my wife said when he appointed Summers, it was the scream heard around the world.
Yeah.
But it goes beyond that with people like Vilsack and Salazar. Why did he pick these people?
This goes to a fundamental issue of Barack Obama's judgment. Back during the campaign, remember, there was a debate between Hillary's experience and Obama's judgment. Obama says, I've got judgment. Whatever Hillary's long experience is, my judgment will be more important. Well, what you have here is a situation where he arrives without experience for the most part, and he makes errors of judgment even before he gets to the Oval Office.
Is that part of the reason for the title of the book, Confidence Men? Because Obama discovers that his lack of experience, he never had a management job before, now he's president of the United States, that he lacks confidence in his own qualifications to manage the financial crisis, so he turns to these uber-qualified Summers and Geithner types?
You said it beautifully, Brian. That's right at the heart of it. And then he's trapped by them. Then he's sort of trapped in his own White House, where, you know, there are moments in the book where literally Obama's kept out of the loop, even on important things. You know, there are moments where he's about to give the health care speech, biggest speech of his presidency at that point, you know, a real crisis speech in the fall of 2009. And Obama has given a couple big speeches, including that great Cairo speech on, you know, East-West relations in the Muslim world. And after that speech, he was saying to the various guys, you know, we need a follow-up of policy. You know, this is the best thing I do is give these speeches. But then they just vanish afterward because we're not coming up with a plan for then what to do. That's a pretty smart thing to say. Well, after the health care speech, he's got it ready and he's really feeling excited about it. He thinks they're going to release a fully architected, a fully realized healthcare plan at that point, right on his speech. As he gives a speech, it'll be released to the public. He thinks that all the way up to the moment he gives the speech.
Huh.
Rahm has decided he's not doing that. They're putting up a little two-page thing of bullet points.
Right.
But the president is talking about it in a meeting, and people are saying, no, Mr. President, we're just doing the bullet points. Rahm shuts them down.
Wow.
No, don't tell the man.
So who's in charge here?
Ugly.
Jim
ugly.
In Spring Lake. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Hey, Jim.
What you got?
So I just want to know, in the time that you were able to spend with the president, did you just get the sense that he just really lacks the fortitude to piss people off by being bold and saying, this is what my gut is telling me, you know, it's informed by the information that I'm given, and yeah, I may disagree with, you know, every one of you in the room, but I'm the president, at the end of the day, I'm going to make a decision, and people are going to like it. If they like it, great. If they don't, they're going to vote me out of office.
That exact attitude is something that people are constantly looking for, poking at them. Come on, isn't it in there? Where is it? Show me. Now, there are times where the words sometimes seem to be just like you said, but the actions then kind of dissolve. They don't follow it up strongly. I mean, you know, at one point someone said he doesn't care if people like him or not. I don't think that's right at all. You know, he might not have the warmth and the sort of hugging, gushing qualities of Clinton, but he's very attentive as to what people think of him. And he has trouble having people think ill of him because he's being decisive. You know, I mean, he is the central actor of this era in American history. And for better or for worse, his evolution as an individual will also mirror or carry forward, for better or for worse, the evolution of the country. He is the main guy. And I'm not sure if he's going to evolve or not, but that's what people are asking for.
Paul in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, Brian. Great topic. Mr. Susskind, enjoy your books.
Hey, thanks.
Just a quick question. Does your book confirm what Rush Limbaugh has been saying for the last 2.5 years, that President Obama is not qualified to be president and that he's indecisive and doesn't have a policy plan in place?
I don't think it confirms Rush, but it shows the president struggling to be the president people seem to be asking for. There's no doubt about that. And it shows him recognizing that that is the problem, and trying to essentially fit his essence, his personality, into the needs of this moment.
One more. Joel in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hello, Joel.
Yeah, hi. Does the non-appointment of Elizabeth Warren show that there's a sexism in the White House at that point? Before, I mean, Hillary Clinton aside.
Yeah. Well, there's a great moment between Kristi Romer and Elizabeth Warren. Warren's coming in there to do her kind of job interviews in August of last year after the Financial Reform Act passed. And there are campaigns, viral videos, petition drives, please make this person head of this agency. And it doesn't seem like it's going to happen. But Warren talks to Romer, who's, you know, the Council of Economic Advisors, and she convinces Romer that she's the right person for the job. And Romer sort of looks at her, kind of saying, you know, why is it always the women? Why is it the women are the only ones with balls around here? That's a bad quote for the White House, but it is a quote that goes to the heart of some of their problems, is that, you know, the women essentially are stepping in to say, gosh, you know, just do it. Just do it. You can't know the consequences. There'll be many unintended consequences. That's the way real action looks. And this is really a crisis in that way. Now, Elizabeth Warren, you follow all the way through. And the dilemmas of Elizabeth Warren, I think, go to the heart of it, of the kind of technocratic problem that the administration, the president at the center of it had. Warren is playing in a whole nother playing field. She's playing on the wider American cultural field. And I'll just sort of confirm this quickly in terms of a comment that I got from someone on Wall Street. I said to this guy, a Wall Street titan, I said, what drives you so crazy about Elizabeth Warren? I said, you know, her policies, you know, that consumer stuff is pretty plain vanilla stuff, you know, stopping fraud, educating consumers. She's like, no, he said, no, that's not it. It's that if that woman moves forward, then the financial crisis will have created one true innovation, a rock star regulator. She will be imitated by 1,000. They'll line up around the block because the notion of what a regulator is will somehow and some – it will be sexy. It'll be the thing you want to be. You're not just a guy with a green visor. You're a cop.
And they don't want that on Wall Street.
If that happens, they're cooked, and they know it.
We're just about out of time, but I do want to mention related to this,
yeah,
the news story breaking out around your book, which is the quote – from White House Communications Director Anita Dunn on the climate of sexism in the West Wing. As she sees it, you have her saying the White House could be in court for having the classic legal requirements of a hostile work environment. But she now says that was only part of the quote.
Yeah,
she said, wait, just so people know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
She said, if it weren't for the president, it would be that sexist a place. Which did she say?
Well, she said the first one. She said, you know, I said to Valerie Jarrett in the White House, if it wasn't for the president, this place would be in court for a hostile workplace because it fits the legal definitions. The way I did this book to try to have sources, they spend hour after hour with you, want to go over with them at the end of the day. Here's what's next to your name in the book. I did that with Anita Dunn right before publication. She said, well, you know, my husband, remember, he's general counsel, so if I'm citing a legal problem in terms of sex issues, sexism, I have to kind of tell my husband I didn't do that. That's a bit of a problem. I tell you, though, this year in 2011, you know, I would be more comfortable if you said, looking back, that's what I felt. It fit the hostile environment. As to the point about if it wasn't for the president, I said to Anita, I said, that never made much sense. What do you mean if it wasn't for the president? You know, if it was for a different guy, you would feel differently about the actual workplace issues? She said, no. That's just us saying we love the president. That's just me saying we love the president. We walk across hot coals for the guy. So basically we agreed in the quote as it appeared in the book. The whole affection for the president still among the women is the preceding graph, as you'll see in the page. And then the full quote, looking back, this would fit the legal definition of a hostile workplace. You know, the White House pushes back. I think those sideshows are over now, but I did something that I tend not to do. I called in the Washington Post and said, here's the tape, listen to it, here's the history of that quote, and I think that's all settled now. But
Ron Suskind, his brand new book is called Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. Thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure.
By the way, folks, tonight at 9, there's a Republican debate in Florida among the presidential hopefuls. As always, our politics website, It's a Free Country, is hosting a live online chat during presidential debates. Get together with WNYC It's a Free Country reporter Anna Sale, Nicole Gelinas from the Manhattan Institute, and your fellow political junkies. All you need is a computer and a love of the debate. Chat live online during the debate tonight starts at 9 at itsafreecountry.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, why legislators in Albany are breaking their promise on nonpartisan redistricting and why that matters to you. And we'll hear the story of the daughter of an immigrant maid in the United States who winds up growing up in the employer's home. What's it like to grow up around privilege without being privileged yourself? Coming up, stay tuned.